The payday loan industry rakes in billions in Florida. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Lobbyists for the industry were at Trump National in Doral recently. The annual convention focused in part on removing Obama-era regulations. Religious leaders protested, claiming that these loans target the working poor. We're going to learn more about the industry and how people can find help if they get caught in a cycle of debt. Also, Uber's trying to clean up its image, especially on allegations and reports of sexual harassment and sexual assault. The company's chief legal officers in South Florida meeting with political leaders and advocates to get input on how to make ride sharing safer. Finally, a conversation about the March title of the Sundial Book Club, Their Eyes Were Watching God. We're going to learn more about author Zora Neale Hurston. We're going to hear from the head of the Hurston Museum in Eatonville, Florida. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The payday loan industry is flourishing in Florida to the tune of $2.5 billion just in fees over the last 10 years, this according to a 2016 report. These loans that are marketed as quick cash to help one get to their next paycheck often come with high interest rates. Studies show these rates keep people in a destructive cycle of debt. Now, last week, the Community Financial Services Association of America, which lobbies on behalf of the payday lenders, held their annual conference at Trump National in Doral. Faith leaders from South Florida and across the country protested the event, arguing that payday lenders disproportionately target low-income minority groups. Angel Pittman was among the protesters. She's vice president of the nonprofit organization Touching Miami with Love. Angel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us from the studios of WUNC in Durham, North Carolina, is Charla Rios, a researcher at the Center for Responsible Lending. They're focused on payday loan practices. Charla, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Luis, and thank you for your listeners for having me as well.
Great to have you both. And I do want to know, just so everybody knows, we did invite the CFSA to take part in today's conversation. CFSA CEO Dennis Shaw submitted the following response, quote, "Small dollar loans are a vital source of credit for millions of Americans who, in many cases, aren't served by traditional banks. U.S. government research found that in 2017, more than 30 million Americans were unbanked or underbanked, and 40% of Americans either could not cover or would struggle to cover an unexpected expense of $400. Small dollar loans are often the least expensive option for consumers, particularly compared to bank fees, including overdraft fees and bounced checks. CFSA member companies abide by a set of mandatory best practices to further enhance consumer protections and address the evolving credit needs for our customers. These best practices ensure that member companies continue to hold themselves to a higher standard of responsible lending and help consumers make informed financial decisions." Again, that is the statement from CFSA CEO Dennis Shaw. You know what? Let me start with both of you, actually. I kind of wanted to get your take on this because we're going to talk about the payday loan industry here, especially in Florida. But Charla, let me start with you. Your take on the response.
Sure. So I think when we talk about payday loans, it's important to remember that payday lending is marketed as a quick financial fix, but in reality, it causes a long-term debt trap. So you mentioned earlier about the $2.5 billion over 10 years in fees, and that equates to about $300 million drained annually. So when we talk about some of the harms around payday loans and the idea that the industry believes that it protects consumers from fees and has the least cost, those are some of the exact harms that are caused by payday loans. So research has shown that payday loans have resulted in overdrafted accounts, overdrafted fees, some end in bankruptcy, and bounce checks. So when we think about this, let's think about it as far as being a long-term debt trap instead of a quick fix.
And Charla, you know, every state is different in the rules and regulations of these loan companies. But how big is the payday loan industry in Florida?
Sure. So when we think about the average interest rate on a Florida payday loan, it's over 300%. To be exact, it's 304%. So it's quite a big amount of fees that's associated with a payday loan. You can also think about the number of storefronts. So in Florida, there are more payday lenders than Starbucks. And we know how ubiquitous Starbucks are in Florida, but across the nation. So just think about that amount of payday lenders in your state alone.
And then, of course, you can also get loans online. There are apps. There are all kinds of different ways to be able to get a payday loan. The other thing, too, Charla, is do we get a sense of where these stores are concentrated? Do you know that?
Yes. So based on our research, in Florida, we know that high minority areas have twice the number of stores per capita as white neighborhoods. And so specifically in our research, we found that per 1,000 persons, census tracts with over 75% Black and Latino populations have 6.5 payday storefronts as compared to 2.7 payday stores in tracts with less than 25% Black and Latino populations. So there's definitely a disproportionate concentration in these high minority neighborhoods of payday lenders.
All right. Angel Pittman, you were part of this group that was out there at the event recently. Mm-hmm. This is at the Trump National in Doral protesting. But real quickly, I mean, look, I read off again, the CFSA CEO Dennis Shull's response. Again, they didn't join us for the program today, but they're talking about, well, there are a lot of Americans that are unbanked or underbanked, and they need a little bit of help. What's your take on his stance there?
Well, it is true that for a lot of people, they think that this is their quickest and best option. Most borrowers are overly optimistic about their ability to repay, but the fact is that 80% of these loans we're talking about are taken out to repay previous loans. So that cycle that Charla just mentioned is what's happening. I mean, if the case were made that one single loan of an average of $450 is what's helping be a stopgap for families, then it wouldn't be such a problem. But that's not true. Because of these enormous APR rates, folks can't pay off those fees. And so they're averaging 10 loans because they're getting a loan to pay off what they previously didn't pay. And so that escalation is compounding the problem for these communities, and particularly, as she mentioned, low-income communities where the slick marketing, inviting environment, and the promise of 30 minutes and you walk out with cash is really what's trapping folks.
Why is Touching Miami with Love connected in this issue? And again, why were you out as part of the group that was protesting at Trump National?
Yeah, so Touching Miami with Love, as a local nonprofit here in South Florida, knows that the financial health of families is really a major part of family life. And so our programs and services for children and youth are meant to support a whole healthy family. And so we know that if a family is in severe financial crisis, then they're not going to be whole and healthy. And we want to be part of the conversation. And so we do financial education. We've held roundtable discussions on this. But the thing that I think is important for listeners to understand is it's the behavior, not of the customer, that needs to be regulated, but it's the behavior of the lenders that's the problem.
You've run into people who they've gotten caught up in the cycle of debt on these. Mm-hmm. What kind of stories do you hear?
Well, you know, one of the stories that very clearly illustrates it is from our broader network of the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship of Florida, which is part of a national organization of the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, which has taken up payday lending as a major advocacy effort. And there's a story of John from on the West Coast, who was a nurse, had a steady paycheck, but like a lot of us, had an unforeseen bill come up that he couldn't pay, so he was short of cash. So he took out what is very typical, a $450 loan. But in order to secure that loan, he gave a blank check, which is commonly required. Well, what that meant was that the vendor had first access to his
This is usually how you pay back. They
yes.
go into your account to
yeah,
take their payment.
Yeah, they just take it. Exactly. And so after that loan ended, the vendor deducted the $500, which was the $400 principal and $50 in fees and interest. But because that had been taken off the top of his paycheck, it again put him with not enough money to cover his costs for the next 2 weeks until he was paid again. So he went out and took another loan. This cycle for John continued for 12 months, and he ended up having $1,050 in debt for what was a $450 loan.
Charla, I wondered in your research, you know, what you found as to how often people got into that cycle where they would get another loan, and on, because, I mean, Angel said up to 10, but what do you see in how many loans people have to take out?
Sure. Well, it's unfortunate to hear this specific incident of John taking out a $400 loan on accruing over $1,000 in fees. Specific to Florida, I will say that our research has shown that 83% of borrowers have seven or more loans, and around 88% of borrowers have already taken out another loan before they owe on that first loan. So again, this is a cycle of a debt that is marketed again as a quick fix or a short-term loan, but ends up being a much longer-term loan. And that's something that I don't think that borrowers initially think about when they enter into the cycle. It's, again, marketed as a short-term, but it ends up based on the structure of the loan or the business model to be longer term.
Charla, help me understand this, because from the research that I know, Florida passed a law going back to 2001, the Deferred Presentment Act, and it was intended to protect borrowers. It established a one loan at a time limit, a 24-hour wait period between loans, inclusion of an extended payment plan and credit counseling, as well as a database to track activity and compliance with the law. I'm just looking at the first part of that. One loan at a time. So it doesn't seem like that law has no teeth.
Correct. Yeah, it just didn't seem to work. So the idea that some of the provisions that you just mentioned were highlighted in that 2001 law. However, again, the research that we have seen shows that there's at least 88% of repeat payday loans that were originated before the borrower receives their next two-week paycheck. So it just shows that the law isn't as effective as it was once hoped to be.
Now, one of the other things, too, is the fact that, look, this group got together recently here in Doral because one of the things they'd like to see is a loosening of Obama-era regulations to boost business. And part of that is, again, in the requirements for lenders when they're finding somebody for a customer. What are the rules right now? I mean, you know, is it easy to get a loan? It sounds like it is.
Yes. So specific to Florida, it seems that that is the case. So there was another law that was passed in 2018 focused on payday lenders, and they were able to get a new high interest debt trap product legalized in Florida in addition to the one that they already have from 2001. And it allows payday lenders to make those make loans up to $1,000, which overrides the current $500 limit with longer terms. So terms that are 60 to 90 days as well, which can put people in a deeper, longer lasting debt trap. There's also the CFPB, or the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And initially, that 2017 rule that I think you're referring to would have taken into account a 45-length term period. So this Florida law kind of overrides that with the 60 to 90-day terms, and also would have introduced ability to repay requirements, which would have taken into account expenses that families had. So the rule that was introduced in 2017 would have protected millions of Florida families, but currently is being looked at to be repealed.
I'm talking with Center for Responsible Lending researcher Charla Rios and Vice President of Touching Miami with Love, Angel Pittman. And we're talking about the concerns surrounding the payday loan industry in Florida as the lead organization advocating for payday loans. They all met recently at Trump National in Doral last week. There was a protest out there. Angel Pittman was part of that group. And again, looking at what the rules and regulations are for these payday loans and how easy is it to get one. And we're finding from the research that people, they don't just take out one, they're taking out multiple loans, falling into a cycle of debt. And these loans have interest rates of 300% and up. If, by the way, you've ever taken out these loans, we'd love to hear your story, your thoughts on these. You can find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. If you work in the industry, we'd love to hear from you. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the industry and how it does business and about these interest rates and if you think those are fair. Again, find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Angel, you know, the other thing, too, because you work with families, you've heard stories. I read some of these that some people are hurting their kids' futures because they're putting their kids' names and social security numbers, you know, on these application forms. So they're taking out loans on their kids, and those kids are going to end up, you know, they're going to suffer down the road for that.
Well, and I think it's when you lose options. And so these aren't parents who are making bad financial decisions because they don't care about the future of their kids. It's that they lack a safety net for the here and now. And so oftentimes when it comes to doing their taxes, then it gets uncovered that that social security number is associated with other things. And so the concern is just how to protect families who are our most fragile in our community. And you know, as a faith leader, as an organization of faith leaders, we all know that across whether it's Judaism, Islam, or Christianity, that each tradition has a teaching against these excessive rates of interest.
This issue is important to you because of your faith.
Yes.
What is it?
Well, throughout, I as a Christian, throughout Christian scriptures, Old Testament and New Testament, it's very clear. And this is, you know, whatever side of the aisle you're on, whether you are a conservative or progressive Christian, everybody agrees on this issue, that the issue of usury and excessive interest on the poor is wrong. It's immoral.
How do you help families? Because you said it a second ago. This is interesting. Look, it's not that people want to hurt their kids, mm-hmm. but you get stuck and mm-hmm. you feel like, I can't pay this bill now. That's what the loans are trying to market themselves as. Hey, mm-hmm. we're help right now if you need it. And then they got to pay that bill and then that bill. And then this comes up. Then there's a car emergency or a medical emergency. But then you take out a loan and then another and then another and another and you get stuck. So, I mean, how do you help families? What do you tell them at the beginning of that whole cycle, how not to get into that cycle?
Yeah, so we just, with a lot of different issues, we just educate our families. And so we've done sessions where we've brought families in, set up our laptops, and showed them how to run their credit score for free. We've had financial experts come in and sit down with families and just break it down, because you watch television for more than 5 minutes, you're going to see a very slick ad for how quick and easy it is to solve your problems. And we all want a quick fix when things are rough. We pop Advil when we have a headache. Families in trouble are no different. And so a big part of that is education, letting them know that this cycle exists, because, as I mentioned before, it's believing that things will get better tomorrow and I'll be able to pay it off.
But are there options? Because again, we're talking, this is part of why they target, you know, folks that need the money right now. I mean, you know, what are the options? Would you tell a family if they come in and talk to you and they say, but I've got this bill, what do I do?
Well, it's important to note that 25 years ago, these loans didn't exist. And so there are other answers. And in fact, in states that have banned or heavily restricted payday loans, survey shows that the residents there are pleased that they're no longer available. And so there are options with credit unions, with financial organizations that support the financial health. We've got Catalyst Miami here in our backyard that does incredibly great work around this issue. So there are options. We need to educate families, and at the same time, we need to restrict this lending industry.
Charla, the other thing too is, let's say somebody gets caught up in that cycle, though. I mean, what's the option then?
If they are caught in the cycle, there is legal aid available in your area. So I believe Dade Legal Aid could be one option. If you do have a complaint, you can contact your Florida Attorney General. But in general, we would recommend not taking out the payday loan. in the first place. And Angel brought up a great point as far as education. And I would say that we would want or need consumer protections as well. And thinking about some of the rules that were in place through the 2017 payday law or rule that was instituted by the CFPB would have provided that for millions of families in Florida.
Angel, go ahead.
I also want to mention the faith community is taking this issue very seriously. And so John's story of getting in that debt trap, it was his pastor who helped lead him out and the church at large that raised money to help him pay off these loans. And so the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, all throughout their network of individuals and churches, they're answering this call and they are helping families pay off those debts, getting them out of that cycle of having to take another loan. And so I think it's something that the faith community has definitely woken up to, and they've been working hard for over a decade now on this issue. But we've got to have the help of the law to regulate.
Charla, to finish up here real quickly, is, you know, again, there are states that have very tight rules on these or have banned these altogether. But what do we see? Have we seen any movement in Florida on, you know, trying to put tighter regulations or looking back at that 2001 law? Or again, it's, you know, perhaps, you know, lawmakers want to loosen things up. It's good business.
Yeah. So if in the case of Florida, it seems like things have actually gone the opposite way, so they've gotten worse based on that 2018 law to allow payday lenders to make loans that are up to $1,000 with longer terms that put people in a deeper, longer lasting debt trap. And we expect that the $300 million annually that's extracted from low income Florida families to actually increase based on those numbers.
And again, we'd love to hear from you. If you have taken out one of these loans, if you've gotten caught up in that cycle, you know, tell us your story and how you got out of it and anything you want to tell people. Or maybe you work in the industry. We want to hear from you. We want to hear from the industry itself and ask, you know, what do you think about the way that you run business? And again, these high interest rates. Share it with us. Find us on Facebook, again, at WLRN Sundial. Charla Rios is with the Center for Responsible Lending Research, and Angel Pittman, again, Vice President with Touching Miami with Love, joining us on this discussion. Charla, Angel, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise.
All right. Still to come, we are going to be talking about our Sundial Book Club title for the month of March. We're going to learn a little bit more about the author, Zora Neale Hurston. There's a museum, did you know that, up in Eatonville, Florida. We're going to learn more about it and her history up there coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, thanks so much for joining us today. Well, this month for the Sundial Book Club, we've been reading Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. Have you been reading the book? Let us know what you think, by the way. Find us on Facebook, our book club. You can ask to join. It's free for everybody. The story centers on a middle-aged black woman named Janie Crawford. She returns to the town of Eatonville, Florida, after a long absence. Now, Janie's a confident woman who has a unique and challenging relationship with men, with her family, and, of course, with the townsfolk. The book is considered a classic, and it's part of numerous high schoolers' curriculums. There is a Zora Neale Hurston Museum in the process of moving right now in Central Florida. Today, we're joined by N.Y. Nathiri, Executive Director of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community, Inc., and the General Manager of the annual Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities, because they have an annual festival. We're going to learn about that as well. She's joining us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando. N.Y. Nathiri, it's such a pleasure.
Pleasure to be on your air.
You know what? Zora Neale Hurston is this important figure to the city of Eatonville. Look, she's an important figure in the literary world, which we're going to talk about as well. But how did Hurston bring attention to Eatonville through her work?
We say that for Zora Neale Hurston and the Eatonville community, there is a symbiotic relationship. If you look at your hand, you have two sides, and on one side we say there is Zora Neale Hurston, and on the other side there is the town of Eatonville, because, or as she called it, her village, her home village, her native village. Zora Neale Hurston was a charismatic, or is a charismatic writer, folklorist and anthropologist, and what she did in her writing was to really bring to life the primary research that she dedicated her life to in documenting the folkways and the traditions of people of African ancestry in the rural South, in the Caribbean, and elsewhere. And so in her literature, there's a continual reference to the people of Eatonville and the community of Eatonville. In fact, Zora Neale Hurston has made Eatonville popularly known as the oldest incorporated African-American municipality in the United States. And because of the dynamism and her fantastic storytelling, in fact, Eatonville has become and is an internationally recognized literary destination.
For people who haven't been, you know, this is a small town that's just a few miles away from Orlando. How do you describe it to people?
We describe Eatonville as a jewel, a treasure that is representative of unique small town Americana. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the condensed Reader's Digest. Years and years ago, there would be a standing article or component of that publication that featured out-of-the-way or little-known treasures of Americana, places that you might stumble on, and once you had visited, you were just really enamored with the place. Eatonville is that historically significant part of the American saga, maybe little known, but because of Zora Neale Hurston, celebrated because of its history, its heritage, and its culture.
You have an interesting connection to Zora Neale Hurston. Please tell us about it.
Well, in fact, I'm assuming you're referencing my mother, who is, God willing, on April 20th, 101 years old. But she knew Zora Neale Hurston as a child. And in fact, she and her sisters are referenced as the Pretty Johnson Girls in one of Zora Neale Hurston's folklore collections, Mules and Men. And so Zora Neale Hurston was a part of my family lore as I was growing up, because my grandmother would talk about her and about how she was a famous person. In part, my grandmother did that because she wanted to instill in us that just because we came from a little community, it did not mean that we could not accomplish wonderful things.
When did you start reading her work?
Honestly, I started reading Zora Neale Hurston's work after the birth of my first child. So I was 25 or 26. I knew Zora Neale Hurston's folk tales from my grandmother because she would tell them as a part of our, bedtime stories. But I did not read Their Eyes Were Watching God until I think I was probably 26. I read it when it was a Penguin classic that cost 99 cents. The book now retails for, I think it is $14.95.
Right, yeah. You know, I mean, and thinking about, again, you know, the stories you grew up listening to, you know, your relatives about Zora Neale Hurston, how did that shape the way you read Their Eyes Were Watching God?
In fact, I was very comfortable in reading it, and I say that because on a consistent basis, we hear teachers and sometimes readers say that they are a little bit uncomfortable initially with the dialect. Zora Neale Hurston writes Their Eyes Were Watching God in narrative, but she is recognized as a master of the use of dialect as lyrical language. And so for me, there was not a difficulty. And we always say to people, if you read it aloud, don't trouble yourself with the apostrophes. But if you read it aloud, you will really understand it very easily, because it is the language without the D's, the T's, and the E's necessarily, but easily understood because the word, what's being written, translates, as it were, into comprehensible English.
And, you know, of course, the big question, too, is how accurate she was in depicting life at the time in Eatonville and depicting Eatonville in the story.
In fact, the folklorists, and this is when we talk about folklorists, we mean people who are trained in the gathering of primary material, source material about folkways, about the people's life. Zora Neale Hurston said that she was most interested, and this was her direct quote, in the Negro furthest down. And so she was very meticulous about the collecting that she did. As a matter of fact, she references the fact that she would repeat stories to her listeners again and again to make sure that she was being very accurate. Now, the folklorists acknowledge Zora Neale Hurston as one of the first practitioners of that craft, and say, were it not for the primary research material that she gathered, we would not have the authentic traditions, the folkways of the rural Southern African American.
I'm talking with N.Y. Nathiri, Executive Director of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community, Inc. We're discussing the life of Zora Neale Hurston and her time in Eatonville, Florida, and of course her classic book, Their Eyes Were Watching God, which is the Sundial Book Club title for the month of March. You know, every year there's this festival to honor her. Where do people come from to learn about, you know, about Zora Neale Hurston and her life, and what's that like?
Well, we say that the Zora Festival, and that's that is the brand that has come from that long name of Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities. We say that the Zora Festival actually has three goals, and they have been the same since the first festival presentation in 1990. That is to celebrate the life and work of Zora Neale Hurston, to celebrate the historic significance of her hometown, Eatonville, as a historic African-American community, and to celebrate the cultural contributions which people of African ancestry have made to the United States and to world culture. So, yes, the name of this special event is in her honor, but it does not mean that each and every one of the festivals focuses solely on Zora Neale Hurston. Now, for example, this past festival, which was our 30th, it was January 26th through the 3rd of February. We had people literally from all over the world. Because this was our milestone event, we called it the global celebration, and in fact, that is what happened. The University of Central Florida here in Orlando hosted the 13th annual biennial conference of the Collegium for African American Research, which is a European-based group of scholars. They came to the university in helping us to celebrate the 30th anniversary, mm-hmm. and the University of Central Florida hosted them specifically because it is our major academic partner here in the Orlando area. Of course, we have relationships with Rollins College and Valencia College in Seminole State, but the University of Central Florida is the longest standing relationship that we've had. Yeah. In addition, the World Conference of Mayors brought delegations here from West Africa, from South America, from the Caribbean, and of course from cities around the United States. And historic Black colleges and universities held a summit hosted by our organization through Spelman College and the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. So for this milestone event, literally people came from all over the world.
I can't let you go without asking you, of course, because we've been mentioning, I mean, it's the Zora Neale Hurston Museum. And my understanding is you're in the process of moving.
In fact, we have moved the physical address on the 20th of March, and we will be reopening on the 15th of July in a new location. Currently, that location is being restored and renovated. However, the organization, the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community, and all of our operations, including tours, we are continuing to do our tours in Eatonville because there are several places that we typically bring people. But yes, we are closed to the public until the 15th of July, but you can still get in contact with us by calling 407-647-3307. You can visit our website, preserveeatonville.org, and that's a double E, PRESERVEEATONVILLE.org. You can also email us at ny@preserveeatonville.org. So we are still, as they say, busy bees, but the museum is closed to the public while we reopen in a location still in Eatonville. A P.O. Box, in case people want to use slow mail, P.O. Box 2057, P.O. Box 2057, Eatonville, Florida, 32751.
And I'll make sure to get all of that online just in case nobody had a pen on them while you were saying all that. Don't worry.
All right.
Again, N.Y. Nathiri, Executive Director of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community, Inc., and the General Manager of the annual Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities. As she said, the museum will reopen again in July. We're going to have all that information up online for you. And again, the book, really one of the beautiful classics, American classics, and it is our March title, Their Eyes Were Watching God, a wonderful read. N.Y. Nathiri, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And remember, you can join our Sundial Book Club on Facebook. Just ask to join. It is time, by the way, just to mention, we have to announce the April title of the book club. For April, we're going to be reading Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls by local author T. Kira Madden. You can learn more about our Facebook group, We're going to be taping an interview with the author soon. So if you have questions for Ms. Madden, you can share them there. We will ask them when we talk to her. All right. Still to come, we're going to have a conversation with Uber's chief legal officer about the company's efforts to deal with sexual assault. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, with spring break and Miami Music Week upon us here, thousands of partiers are in South Florida, and many of them are going to be using ride-sharing apps like Uber to get around. So passenger safety is in the spotlight. Uber has launched a sexual assault awareness campaign in South Florida. From the beginning, Uber has marketed itself as a safe ride home, but it's faced many legal cases dealing with sexual assault, and it's been criticized for not background-checking their drivers. Within the past year, the company's trying to raise the bar on safety. Since joining Uber in 2017, the company's chief legal officer, Tony West, has made plans to be fully transparent about data on sexual assaults that occur with both their drivers and their riders. In South Florida, West is meeting with organizations to work with advocates on how the company could be more proactive, and he joins us now. Mr. West, thank you so much.
Luis, great to be here with you. Thank you so much.
You joined Uber in the midst of these legal cases the company was facing. Since your arrival, you've led the company to work on this transparency report that you plan to release this year. What's the focus of the report?
So the focus of the report is safety incidents that occur on the platform. Safety is our number one priority. We earn trust of our riders, of our drivers, and that trust is completely connected to this concept of safety. People won't trust us if they don't feel safe to either trust themselves or their loved ones to our platform. And so it's absolutely essential that we get this right and earn that trust every single day. And the transparency report is one step among many that we're doing to try to earn that trust by being fully transparent about what happens on the app.
What can you tell us about the report before it comes out? I mean, can you say anything about what you found, or is it going to be divided by regions? I mean, what can you say now?
So let me tell you, I think when you think about the issue of sexual assault, it is obviously a challenge and a problem that affects not just rideshare, but companies all over the country. You know, Sunday Times just had an article about how we see this in the airline industry as well. So we know a couple of things. We know, one, it's a pervasive problem. We know, two, that companies need to do more about confronting the issue and dealing with the issue. And for our part, part of that is taking leadership positions that we've taken in the last year, including committing to release this report. And what it will do is it'll, for the first time, catalog certain incidents, including sexual assault and sexual harassment, that occur on our platform.
All right. This effort, you know, has led Uber to partner with the National Sexual Assault Violence Center. And in reviewing these 212 incidents that occurred in 2017, just briefly tell us about this partnership that you guys have.
So I think the partnership is unique. When we decided to issue this report to release this information, we knew a number of things. One, we knew that sexual assault is one of the most underreported crimes that exists out there. We also knew that we needed partners who were in the space doing good work every single day when it came to advocacy work and other work to prevent sexual assault and sexual harassment. And so we partnered with the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, as well as 80 women's and advocacy groups around the country, to develop a first of its kind classification or taxonomy, a categorization of sexual assault incidents. Because one of the things you quickly learn, and I learned this as a prosecutor working on this issue years ago, is that law enforcement agencies all collect information and data on sexual assault in very different ways. There's no common categorization, so it's very, very difficult to compare apples to apples and to identify best practices that you would then use to reduce sexual violence. And so for the first time, these groups and organizations have helped us to come up with a common way to classify behaviors that are sexual violence behaviors, and to be able to categorize and count those in a very consistent way.
So back in 2017, former Florida Governor Rick Scott signed a bill allowing Uber and your rival company Lyft to conduct their own background checks through a third party. How often do background checks happen right now?
So I'm very pleased to say that we have strengthened our background check process. Before a driver can come onto the app, we do a full background check of criminal records as well as DMV records for any kind of driver infractions. And we do that every single year to ensure that we're staying up to date. But in addition to that, we've introduced something else, continuous screening, continuous checking. So throughout that year, we are continuously looking at records to ensure that we catch certain criminal convictions or criminal infractions or arrests with regard to any drivers, so that we are as up to date and as informed as possible.
How much do you know how much does the company know its drivers? I mean, you think about, this is a very unique area.
It is.
You know, in South Florida, you have a lot of recent immigrants. And we were having this conversation before the program. The times that I've taken an Uber, I've noticed just in conversations with the driver, they had just arrived here.
Mm-hmm.
You got a lot of people who had just arrived here. So, I mean, you know, how well do you know the drivers? Is the program that you have in place, is that enough?
Well, I will say that one of the great things about Uber is that it gives an economic opportunity to so many people who have been locked out and have not had an opportunity to make a living. What we know about the drivers is though is quite a bit. We you know that if you have to have a license from your DMV, you have to be someone that we can then kind of look to see if there are any other records about you in any of the databases that we are checking. And we, once you are on the platform, we want to make sure that you're continuing to act in a way that's safe. And that's why we do the continuous checking.
What happens if there is a complaint against a driver and it gets to the level of, listen, there was sexual harassment or sexual assault? What happens to the driver then?
I got to tell you, those instances, and they unfortunately do happen, they're heartbreaking instances, and one is too many. We don't like to hear those happen at all. The reality is we do 16 million trips a day, and so you're going to have bad things that happen on the platform. And this is one of those things. And what happens is when a report comes in, it immediately goes to a special unit that is trained specially to deal with complaints about sexual harassment and sexual assault. Once we get that report, there is an almost immediate contact that we make with the victim, with the survivor, and we immediately then are able to track who that driver is, where that driver is. In almost every case, we will immediately deactivate that person for a period of time as we do an investigation into a sexual assault. It's one of the few things that we will immediately deactivate for at least a temporary period of time, a driver.
I'm talking with Tony West, Chief Legal Officer for the ride-sharing company Uber. He's a former Justice Department official, and he's in South Florida and is meeting with organizations through the region to discuss safety initiatives that Uber has been working on, again, to deal with this issue of sexual harassment and sexual assaults. Safety for the riders, safety for the drivers as well. You know what? Let's talk about some of these new safety measures that have been implemented by Uber in the last year. Some of them include safety information on the app, an emergency button for 911 assistance, rerunning driving and criminal background screening annually, as you just stated, and, of course, monitoring new offense data. Is all of this information right there in front for people, or do you have to go look for it? And we were trying to find it.
Well, I'll tell you, we want to constantly make it easier. And so the emergency button, for instance, is something that is very easy to find when you open up the app. And we've actually gotten lots of feedback from riders to tell us how we can make it even easier to access. A one-touch button that will immediately connect the rider to 911. And in fact, in South Florida, we'll be rolling out later this year something that automatically transmits your real-time location data to 911. So you literally will just have to press that button. You don't even have to say anything, and that information will automatically go to 911. So that'll be rolling out later this year. But some of the other things that you mentioned, one safety feature in the app that we've developed are trusted contacts, where you can choose up to five people to send your real-time trip data to. It's something that I use in my own family with my daughter. I like to know if she's riding late at night, she may send that information to me as one of her trusted contacts or to her husband. But it does allow us to be able to make sure that people can know where we are.
So you had a meeting, I believe, earlier. You were talking with the Miami-Dade Chamber of Commerce.
That's right.
Right after this, you're heading over. You're going to be talking with the Women's Fund of Miami-Dade.
That's right.
Look, you're meeting with all these groups because you're talking about what Uber's doing to make things safer. I want to know, what are you hearing from people? What are you hearing from officials here locally about the issues, what they're hearing from people? What are the concerns?
Well, I think people are quite pleased, quite frankly, that there is a willingness by companies and by this company in particular to confront this issue. This is a difficult issue. Sexual violence, sexual assault, sexual harassment, these are not easy topics to talk about. The Me Too awareness has Me Too movement has raised cultural awareness when it comes to this issue, and I think it has given us the opportunity and the responsibility to confront it and to confront it squarely. And so for Uber, for instance, under a year ago, we were the first company in our industry to end mandatory arbitration for individual claims of sexual harassment and sexual assault. We apply that not just to our employees, but to anyone who uses the platform. We ended the use of confidentiality agreements to shield survivors from being able to tell their stories. And we committed to this transparency report, taking concrete actions to address the issue of sexual assault and sexual harassment. I think it is not as usual as it should be. I'd like to see more companies, frankly, standing up and doing this, because as proud as I am of Uber being a leader in this area at this point, I think real change happens only when we can get a good critical mass of companies to follow suit.
Let me finish with this, because Uber is in numerous countries, but I'm wondering, when you're setting up standards and rules, and of course you're talking about training for employees, does it change from state to state, region to region, country to country?
It's a great question. Certainly, we are a very local, global company, right? We are in 65 countries around the world, and yet we operate in these local jurisdictions with local customs, with local laws. And in order to be effective and to serve the customers well in those jurisdictions, we, of course, need to abide by those local rules, local customs, local laws. That said, You know, safety is a standard that is something that we promulgate throughout the entire company around the world. There are no different standards of safety depending upon, you know, what country you're in. We have a high bar of safety that we are maintaining throughout the world, and that we're going to hold ourselves accountable to, because you can bet that if we don't do it, certainly riders will hold us accountable to it.
Tony West, Chief Legal Officer for the ride-sharing company Uber and former Justice Department official, again, in South Florida meeting with organizations as Uber trying to tackle this issue of sexual harassment and sexual assault, protecting riders and protecting their drivers. Mr. West, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
It's great to be with you. Thanks so much.
And that's our program for today, this Tuesday, March 26th. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.